Unity is strength. We got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Come. Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now, right now.
We have to do it right now, y'all. And I mean like yesterday. We are in deep, deep. That stuff you know about. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here at Harris Stowe State University, our historically black university. And anything that I say or my guests say may or may not be the opinions of Harris Stowe State University or the Black Radio Hall of Fame. But I'm thinking they may agree with some of the stuff. We are here because we connect the folks who are struggling on the battlefield with other folks struggling, and they may be struggling around police accountability, healthcare, education. There are so many battlefronts that we have going. And you know what I've been saying for the last few months? Pick your issue, find your people, and start working. Because you're not going to be able to do all of this, you know, and you got to be focused, but you also got to find some peeps. You got to find a community of people who think like you and who are as passionate as you are about some of these issues. Because, you know, we just got word that, you know, the state is getting ready to take back local control of the police. That is something that this community fought for at least it was a 20-year struggle. How do I know that? Because I was in it. And so, what does that mean when a legislature, basically white, basically Republican, says whatever you all think you need and you vote on it doesn't make a difference? And I'm even talking about, you know, the abortion rights that they're trying to, you know, take back. They're also trying to take back paid leave and the minimum wage. I mean, this, you know, you're talking about, these are some of the signs that we're moving towards totalitarianism, because the democratic piece of this is just not going anywhere, and it's being really dismantled. So that means we got to fight harder, y'all. We got to fight harder, but we got to fight smart. We got to be more strategic. We got to be more disciplined, and so or else our communities are going to be ungovernable in the next few months because of what's happening in D.C., what's happening on the state level, and what we see happening with the mayoral races here. It doesn't look good, y'all. So we got some work to do. The two guests that I have today, the reason they're here, I mean, they are both very involved in different things in the community. But why they are here today is because they are historians in their own right. And Linda Nance has been here before talking about the Annie Malone Foundation. And not enough of us still know of her legacy and her contribution. So we want to talk a little bit about that today. And we also want to talk to Tulia Hamilton, who did this wonderful piece on the Phyllis Wheatley YWCAs. And it chronicles the history of some of the Negro women's clubs back in the day, and that's what brings these two people together. Because one of the things I marvel about you all is how these women, not that far from slavery, out of slavery, were able to do some of the phenomenal things that they did. And that just makes me just be in awe of them, because I look at what we have today, what women have at their disposal today in terms of developing themselves, way more than what these women had. Mm-hmm. And so for you to become a millionaire from hair products, and you actually quit school to do this, That to me, it's just mind-blowing. So welcome, Linda and Tulia. We're going to get down and start talking about our beautiful women, these sisters back in the day that had little but did a lot. So I'm going to start with you, with Annie Malone. Let's talk a little bit about what she's done, because I know there's still, even today, people that confuse her with C.J. Walker, who's the millionaire and who invented all the products, but she was actually a protege of Annie Malone. So talk about a little bit about Annie Malone and her philanthropy, her business savvy, and how this whole notion of women being responsible for their communities manifested in the way that she moved and grooved.
I can tell you that it takes a page from what you just said in terms of people taking action to do things. Annie Malone had a dream to teach people how to take care of their hair better. And she felt that in doing that, you have a particular self-esteem. You have a particular uprightness that makes people address you in a different way. So she didn't just do hair care. She did a lifestyle that she encouraged people to become involved in, and providing them with a way to change their economics for themselves had a great part in that uplift that they had. She belonged to an organization, the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, who believed in lifting as we climb, and she lived that. She didn't just talk that. She lived that. Here in St. Louis, she came in 1902 to St. Louis. She started a business in 1900. And trained through her lifetime 75,000 women, and had colleges in different states in the United States, had service stations, supply stations, if you will, in different parts of the country, so that nobody could mess with her ability to provide her product to her agents. And she constantly said, don't just do your business. Be involved in the business of your community. Buy a house. Buy bonds, buy stocks, be a part of that community to fix it, to uplift it, to do whatever you needed to do to fix yourself in that community as an upstanding member of that community. And because of that, there grew a camaraderie between women. She even told them in the early 1940s that if you don't take care of this business, somebody's going to come get it. And she was very right
and
about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she did.
She was very right about
she
that.
She was right.
At one particular point, people did not think that the beauty that women saw or sought as black women was anything of value. And she said, oh, yes, it definitely is. Mm. And that was a part of that self-esteem that she was courting people to take care of. Hers was a community kind of philosophy. Mm. She felt that, and I read something somewhere that said, this is not my money. This is God's money. And she gave it quite freely and quite frequently. Often the newspapers would call her a giving freak, actually, because she put her money where her mouth was and tried to improve her neighborhood and encouraged her beauty agents to do the same thing. So I think that her spirit was one of community. And she believed in community power and community prayer. She would send memos out to say, let's pray at 1 o'clock on this particular day, because if all of us are praying together, we got real power. And you are very right that she was the teacher for Madam C.J. Walker. She employed her in the St. Louis area and then sent her to Colorado to sell her wonderful hair grower, which she did create, and learned by way of other agents that Madam C.J. Walker was representing that as something of her own. Mm-hmm. And there was a bit of a falling out. And no, I was not there to know what exactly that was. But I can tell you that shortly after she discovered that, she published in newspapers in Colorado, beware of imitators. And she patented a particular seal that basically said, if you don't see this seal on that product, it's not mine.
Wow. Another part of a history that we didn't know about. So I remember when you sent me your paper about the how Phyllis Wheatley, YWCA, got built here and all that went with it. Right after that, I was in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio. Uh-huh. And part of the conference took us on a tour through the black community. Mm-hmm. And one of the stops was at the Y.
It was the oldest black.
Yeah, and this brother, who mm-hmm. was our guide, knew everything about that building. I mean, down to the bricks. So I am so happy that they had him there. But he talked about some of the same things that's in your paper,
mm-hmm.
how the community raised money for it.
Right.
'Cause
no government grants.
No right? government grants, but no here's the thing, Toya. The reason I think this is important, because people will see a Phyllis Wheatley Y, they will see a Y with a black name on there, and they think that's the good graces of the YWCA. Not the case. And so these communities fought for recreational facilities in their neighborhoods. They raised the monies, and in some cases, they actually physically built the buildings.
Annie Malone did, from the ground up.
I mean, like black folks building brick by brick. So talk a little bit about what inspired that paper and what you found surprising about the way that facility was built. Mm-hmm. And also the time that it was built, because again, it's this whole Negro Women's Club. Like, you could see all of that, you know, that lifting
as we climb.
Yeah,
really kind of patronizing, right? Because we're always going to be on top, right? We're going to help the rest of you along. But yeah, first of all, though, Jamala, I think we ought to really acknowledge this space that we're sitting in. This used to be the Vashon community. I didn't grow up here, but I remember seeing the name Vashon.
Mm-hmm.
My dissertation is about the National Association of Colored Women. And I said, oh, yeah, Susan Paul Vashon was one of the leaders. She and her husband, George.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to acknowledge it may be that the Wheatley Building and this building may be all that's really left of the institutional black community in Mill Creek Valley. I don't know.
I think so.
Yeah, so I think we need the idea.
Yeah, because Vivian Gibson came by here one day and basically said that, yeah.
Okay, yes, I was excited about the idea of sitting in this space and talking about some of those women.
Let me just say this. One of the things for me, I was disappointed that they took the name off of the building, because for a long time it was Vashon Community Center, and I would always say, go to the Vashon, and then I looked up one day and it wasn't there. It was like Harris Stowe, and I get that, but yeah, so because now the erasure starts to happen, and we are a part of that, so
I could not agree with you more. Yeah, maybe we can do something about that. I thought maybe the way I want to start, though, is maybe talking about how I got interested in black women's organizations. So I was in graduate school. I'd always loved history, knew I was going to be a history major, right? Those were in the days when, there were still jobs available for history majors. But I, as an undergraduate, I joined Delta Sigma Theta. And I'd always been kind of interested in women's issues, you know, even as a little girl. I remember being in junior high school and thinking, well, why do I have to take home ec? Why can't I take shop? Not that I was interested in it, right? I was in no interest. Mm-hmm. I said, why? So I always had an interest in these issues. Well, the history of Delta Sigma Theta, which you have to learn, was started when 13 women who were AKAs decided they wanted to join a women's suffrage march. I had never heard any kind of information or anything that indicated women's suffrage, that there were ever any black women involved, you know, in anything like that. It's what's the name of the book, came out in the 80s, but all the women are white.
Mm.
All the men are black, and some of us are just brave. Yeah, so, you know, so I was really looking for the ways in which black women were involved in the suffrage movement. But I kept coming across this group, National Association of Colored Women, kept coming up, you know, did a little bit more digging and some research. And there are a couple of things I want to point out about that specific time. And Linda, you know about the letter from Jax, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Around the turn of the century, the image of black women, They were natural prostitutes. Natural prostitutes. There was no such thing as a moral black woman. The reason the black race is degraded, it's because of their women have such low morals. Okay, that was kind of a prevailing notion. It was almost, if I give you a black version of, you know, the dichotomy for women, you're either the Madonna or the whore. For black women, you were the mammy or the whore, right? Okay, that was kind of the dichotomy. And what happened was Ida B. Wells, the journalist, you know, about Ida B. Wells, you know, during her crusade in England, a guy from Missouri.
He was head of the press in St. Louis, wrote an ugly letter.
He was reading about Ida B. Wells getting people excited in England about stopping lynching and what was going on. So he wrote a letter back saying, well, you folks in England, you don't know who you're talking to.
Well, I believe her.
Black women are whores. You don't need to. Right. He says, I've heard of them, you know, and I've heard people talk about virtuous black women, but I have never seen one.
Whoa.
So it was kind of one of the reasons you find black women getting together. That's, you know, to kind of fight against this notion of who and what black women were. And you see that. The interplay here, the Phyllis Wheatley wise, you said, you know, the YW, certainly did a lot of organizing in the black community. Some of the earliest social workers were, of course, early black social workers were involved at some level in the YWCA. A good example of how the NACW clubs worked, they didn't decide we're going to be the Y. Right? They helped to get the Y started. You know? They helped to instigate to get that started. And I think that, you know, along with this notion of changing black women, they're in the era of Booker T. Washington. Okay, so this was an era in which, you know, by and large, it's known as the nadir, you know, highest number of lynchings in the country. The institution of Jim Crow laws, so that there was a much more emphasis in the black community on self-help,
yeah,
you know.
Working together.
And then Elijah Muhammad used to say, do for self. Lots of do for self, right, in the period kind of between 1890 and World War I, right?
Exactly.
Help yourself, emphasis on black pride, black culture, although most people don't believe this, but the term Afro-American, these people wouldn't believe it, actually came from Booker T. Washington, which some of you would find shocking. Yeah. And it's interesting because one reason I think the NAACP is, you know, Association of Colored People, because they didn't want to use that Booker T. Washington term. Okay, but anyway, that didn't mean that the protests stopped, but clearly they were focused on building communities, building their communities. And there was also, I found, the notion, and you won't find this surprising. I mean, they were pretty out front about it. Black women are better than white women. I mean, we've been through slavery. We've struggled. We've done things most white women can't even dream of. Like I jotted down, this is from a poem. Now, this is middle-class bourgeois black woman, okay? That's what I want to be clear about, who they are. They believed in those Victorian bourgeois ideals and tried to meet up to them. But in one of the publications, to give you a sense of this, a woman wrote this poem, out of the wilderness of night has the black woman crawled to the dawn of light. She's come from the valley of despair. She has borne what no white woman could ever bear. I mean, that they really did have this sense of being extraordinary, right? That God somehow endowed black women in particular with this kind of strength. And they intended to use it to build their communities. And a lot of the work you see in the Phyllis Wheatley Y would be mirrored around the country. A lot of black hospitals got their start from Association of Colored Women's Clubs. As a matter of fact, when people say, so whatever happened, what happened to all this stuff? I said, well, once the Urban League was established, particularly in urban areas, they kind of took over a lot of these activities. But I don't know if that really is the long way to answer question, but understanding, you really need to have to understand. And they were critical of black men who were into color, right? Mary Church, I think it was Mary Church Terrell, who was herself a light-skinned black woman.
Yes.
You know, she said, we need to cease imitating the artificial standards of others when it comes to beauty.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things Annie Malone knocked down. The standard of beauty was this white woman with straight hair and ruby red lips kind of thing.
Well, it still is.
But Annie Malone said very clearly, you're beautiful just like you are. Just groom what you got.
Yeah, unfortunately, I am just shocked. I'm in my 70s. I went through Black is Beautiful, and to see that professional athletes all seem to be married to the same woman.
Who pretty much wipes them out after they get divorced. Yeah.
No, but I mean physically.
Yeah. No,
they all look alike. And I'm saying, so how did that,
Where did that standard come from?
Well, no, what happened? What happened to us?
You're talking about after the sort of Black is Beautiful
right,
stuff.
Yeah, so how did we get to this? You know, I haven't
Because there's always this backlash of, okay, y'all got some victories or y'all think this, but we're getting ready to push all that back and submerge it. So it that comes frequently.
Right.
It's almost like a circular thing. But I do want to say that the women's club, and you talked about the bourgeois aspect of it, because I think that's one of the criticisms I hear about the clubs, because particularly how they looked at women coming from the South, like we need to get them civilized so that they fit in. And some of that wasn't all bad because I know if I was coming from the South or the North, I'm like, okay, what do I need to be doing? All of that.
Standards are not a problem. It's whose standards are we talking about? If I'm setting standards for a group of people who look like me, I still got standards. Mm-hmm. I still have a point at which I want people to rise to. Annie Malone used to teach her folks how to walk, talk, sit, stand, do product, do books, order product. And when you talk about making those millions of dollars, she was a multimillionaire, off of 50 cents for this and 75 cents for that, your distribution has to be so large. It's not funny.
Well, it was actually worldwide.
It was worldwide. And in 1914, when she was on the grounds that is Harris Stowe grounds, before Harris Stowe was here with her second location here in St. Louis, she was pulling down $3,000 days. Mm-hmm. And my first thought was, black people were in the hair like that.
They're still in the hair like that.
They're still in the hair like that.
No, we have always.
That's good for today.
$3,000
a day
been into
in any
hair.
Business? Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. We've always been into hair.
Beauty.
But you understand why.
Beauty. Right?
Yeah.
You understand why that's the case.
Well, they use goose grease and fat and lye and lard on their hair to try to relax those really tight curls.
Sulfur and sage.
There we go. And you ended up ruining your scalp. Mm-hmm. But Annie Malone said, oh, no, you don't have to do that. And you can have a full, beautiful head of hair, too.
Mm.
And she really sold that lifestyle that gave people the image that said, I can improve myself by improving the way I feel about me and the way I look on the outside. And then to teach me how to be economically independent. Well, I can send my own children to school. I can buy my own piece of property. I can have my own agency to decide. When she built that building in the Ville, she built it from the ground up in the middle, or should I say the beginning of the pandemic, the flu pandemic. Everybody around here currently has a reference for what pandemic can do. Well, this lady put her whole life on the line to build this building in the community where she said, you're not welcome at the Keel. You're not welcome in transportation. Mm-hmm. I have a fleet of cars. I have an auditorium, 800-seat auditorium. Mm-hmm. Come here. And she brought entertainers into St. Louis. And we talked about Marian Anderson earlier. Mm-hmm. She brought Marian Anderson in the early 40s. And the performance cost 50 cents to get in. Mm-hmm. She brought a young, vibrant Marian Anderson who everybody has known that particular story about how you can't sing at Constitution Hall because mm-hmm. you're a person of color, and all of a sudden Miss Roosevelt plans and devises a way for you to sing to a national audience at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. So she was into so many different things. Annie Malone was for black people, by black people, and she lived it. She didn't just talk about it.
I'm wondering, though, she obviously, and maybe it's because we're here in St. Louis and it's the Annie Malone home and all that goes with that, that we know her. But surely there were other people, men and women. I know Absolutely. When I think about the male counterpart might be Marcus Garvey. But there seemed to be this whole notion of we are going to be a part of the society. We are going to be integrated in there, and we're going to teach you how to do that so that you fit in. However, don't forget about community. And so so when I think about this term that you used in your paper, Tulia, the social feminism, which was mm-hmm. the first time I heard about that, but it does seem to make sense that the women like Annie Malone and Alice Rector out of Kansas City would be drawn to that kind of concept. So explain what you meant by the concept. So,
yeah, and it's not, you know, it's an idea came from a white historian, a white woman historian. And again, putting things into context, after the Civil War marked a time when white women, particularly middle-class white women, left the home, so to speak. They're involved in things like the Christian, the temperance union. They were involved with stuff. They weren't necessarily, though, interested in issues like women should wear pants, right? We shouldn't have to use our husband's last name. They weren't that kind of feminist. The feminism they exhibited had to do with their role as women. If we're going to be good mothers.
Nurturing.
Right? Yes. Not just nurturing, but if we're going to be good mothers, we can't have liquor being sold around. We got to get rid of liquor, right? If we're going to be good mothers, we've got to address some of these issues, like the quality of food. So black women were a part of that. There was also, I think, and it's important to understand about the NACW, the difference they saw. There was a white women's club movement, too, which you, okay, mm-hmm. going parallel. You know, they didn't want any black women's clubs. A lot of those clubs, even though they're classed as social feminism, were about white women educating themselves, making themselves better, learning new things. The women in the NACW say, oh, no, we're helping a whole race, not just, you know,
not just ourselves.
This is not about us. Mm, you know, right. We're building, we're trying to, you know, really look at a whole race. So it's the kind of feminism that started even the kindergarten movement. You
exactly.
know, some of the things you saw, exactly. that's, yeah, the women saying, well, in our, because of our role as mothers, right, our divinely, right, divine role as mothers, we have to be concerned with what's going on outside our house.
Absolutely.
So it's social feminism in that sense. And that's, you know, another issue. I told you I had never heard of black women being involved in suffrage. This was in the 70s, you know, kind of right when you have the emergence of the women's movement.
Movement, yeah.
And so it's interesting, historically speaking, you know, I was curious because I, you know, studied history. I never quite understood what happened to the abolitionists in the women's rights movement. Mm. Before the Civil War, they were the same people. Mm-hmm. They were the same people. Mm. Switch forward to 1870, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, I forget, we were celebrating, what is it, the 100th anniversary of the 15th and the 19th Amendment. And the 15th Amendment gave black men a vote. 19th Amendment gave white women a vote, right? I shouldn't say it like that.
That's the way that was.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my point was that because the 15th Amendment only gave the vote to black men, white women left the civil rights movement. you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and some of those, they left. Mm-hmm. They actually left. And by the 1900 or so, one of the ways that suffragists promoted passage of voting votes for women was there are more white women than all these black men, and ignorant immigrant men, right? Mm-hmm. So it was pushed as a way to maintain
white supremacy.
White supremacy. So going back, I was going to say about the 70s, when there were some white women talking about, oh, well, black women need to be involved in...
Black women have been involved since 1896.
Well, I'm saying, but because we're sisters in the feminist, mm-hmm. you know, and I always, and at the time, the white women I saw were the white women who were throwing rocks at black children on school buses in Boston, right? So, I mean, it was, I mean, intellectually, I understood, oh, yeah. But just in terms of the lived experience of most black women, right? It's particularly when for a lot of black women, their direct experience of racism came from the white women they worked for.
Absolutely.
And so that was never, and I don't know even now if there's this really any real kind of, well, maybe there is, but understanding of, you know, kind of the role of white women, you know, the idea that, well, we're victims too, just like you. No.
We have been victimized, but I wouldn't go along with just like you.
Just
like you. In 1896, the National mm-hmm. Association of Colored Women formed.
Yeah.
And a lot of those women were precursors to the NAACP.
That's
the
right.
The Niagara Movement.
They were in the Niagara.
They had meetings in their homes. They had organizational meetings for a lot of the struggles that were happening. And as mm-hmm. far as the suffrage movement goes, the women of color mm-hmm. refused to march in the back of the parade most often.
Yeah, that's what I was, yeah.
They refused to not be involved, and they refused to be myopic mm-hmm. in their struggle. As you said, people who were of the white women persuasion were into wearing the pants or doing the stopping the alcoholism that really ruined their families, yes. But black women were for that, but they were also for the rights of men of
Absolutely.
Color. They were interested in the vote for men of color, and they worked for that.
Yeah.
Even though they weren't exactly welcome into that white struggle, they were still there, and I really do believe the struggle for white suffrage for mm-hmm. women got taught a lot from the struggles of African-American women. They were doing it for a long time. They have been doing it for a long time. A lot of the other organizations that formed on college campuses for women, the sororities that formed, mm-hmm. were after 1896 when the National Association of Colored Women mm-hmm. formed their groups. And that whole idea of working together was the biggest thing about them. Yeah. The strength in numbers. A good, less than 40 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, you still had women of color organizing to do just as you said, form kindergartens, hospitals. The whole idea of having teacher training came from people from Oberlin College, came from women mm-hmm. that said, don't turn them loose in a classroom without making sure they have the correct training to teach our children. Don't fail young black men and don't give them industrial arts training because they need to be able to make a living and have a family even though they might not go to school. But they still need the training. So you had industrial arts trainings mm-hmm. for young people. Education was a large portion of all we thought was possible because we were taught for so long we could not learn to. And then when we got an opportunity, it's really, really strange that these people who are not capable all of a sudden can advance so quickly in the first 3 to 5 years after mm-hmm. the Emancipation Proclamation. How in the world could that have happened if you didn't have intelligence in the first place?
Exactly. Well, that's a myth. But you talked about working together, and I think the other fascinating thing to me about the NACW between in this time period, is in the same organization, you had Ida B. Wells, this firebrand, working with Booker T. Washington's wife. I mean, it was a lot of the men's organizations had fallen apart, right? Because they had these. But I've always been really fascinated by the fact that you had people who were clearly in women Washington camp. And you had, like you said, women who were involved with the Niagara movement. They were all in this one organization. And it didn't tear, these differences somehow didn't tear them apart.
No, I always they did have an argument about whether or not women in the organization should be educated or not educated. There was one camp that basically said, if you're a woman who's a Christian woman and you want to do better by your family, by your community, we want you in this organization, and we want to train you. We want to give you opportunities to learn with and for each other. And there's a whole other group of people said, if you're not an educated woman, you need to be someplace else. But the overwhelming group of people said, you can be a slave or have a slave, have a job or have a degree. Doesn't make us any difference. If you're a woman who's a Christian woman who wants to be able to do better for yourself, better for your community, better for your family, better for your children particularly, let's go for it.
Yeah. You know, if you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are talking about the fascinating and illuminating history of clubs like the National Negro Women's Clubs and people like Annie Malone, who fit right into that, and how we have diverged a bit from that. Because when I think about the women's movement, most of the time, not only me, but other folks as well, think about white women and what their particular issues are, which I think, as you've been pointing out, both of you have been pointing out, they include those, but it's so much more. It's broader. So even around, I just wrote about this, so it's fresh in my head, even around choice and the right to a safe and affordable abortion, that wasn't all that we were fighting for, which we said we got to expand it to reproductive justice, reproductive rights, because it's not just that one thing. And it took a while for the white women's movement to embrace that, to say, oh, yeah. So that movement could even be more robust and powerful than what it is. But there's voices that have been left out or have been marginalized. And I think about that march, that women's march, where they went back to the black women. And I can't remember who that was. They said, oh, no, we're going to march, even if we're in the back. But, yeah. And
we're
so
not going to be in the back.
Yeah. So, and then there's this whole thing about being often black women are the ones who get sliced from the power deals, and it happened that way with the voting. It's like, you all are going to be a liability, because if it's white women, we have a better chance, and so we'll pick y'all up later. Well, black women have already been kicked to the curb with the 15th Amendment. Now you're getting ready to do it again. That was me, and I don't know why I turned this thing off and it still went on. So, so we have been kicked to the curb, and we know what that feels like, and we know how it compromises our ability to move forward. And so we've often been forced to self-organize in ways that are creative, ways that, as you say, cross, lines of ideology and
class.
Political class, and you know we've done all of that.
Right.
So what's happened now?
Angela Davis in the 80s
or 70s. Well, maybe she did in the 80s, but I think of her as 70s.
Late 70s, early 80s. You're right about that 70s. One. She basically said, it's not feminism, it's womanism. And the difference is, womanism looks at class, it looks at my sexual situation, and it looks at my economic situation. Feminism is just wanting me to be equal to what a man does. Hello, but the subject matter is much greater than that.
Well, it's the patriarchal principles that we're talking about.
Exactly.
You know, and they're embodied in our current president, right? So it's the notion that the way particularly European men, the definitions for success, right? The things that make a man, right?
Yes.
The realization, those are killing the planet. We need another. We need another way of looking at the world. And, you know, women who were really seeing, well, you know, wait a minute. As women, we have a different view. We don't, you know, I was kind of, again, in the 70s, because I was my research interest, I came into contact with a lot of folks. And I remember for lots of, mostly white women at that point, but some black men, if you were going into corporate America, you had to become a white man. Right?
Pretty
you
much.
You have to subscribe
the suit,
to.
Mm-hmm. Short hair.
Short, the you know.
The look.
Mm-hmm. Well, even, you know, I remember being in academia, and when I made a conscious decision that I would never, that I was not interested in being a white man. I mean, I realized sometimes when I was in graduate school, when I'd walk into class, what was going on was a continuation, right? Of whatever they discussed, the male white male students, whatever they discussed in a bar the night before. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a 2-year-old. I couldn't. You know, I wasn't interested in sitting around with them.
I had
the
that
bar.
Kind of time.
I mean, no, but I mean, it's these things that you don't see that act as barriers. And I said something about it. You know, or I even had when I was pregnant with my daughter. I had one of my colleagues at Ohio State say, oh, nobody's going to take you seriously if you're having a baby and you're still just an assistant professor.
I'm the most serious thing there is on the face of the earth.
Right?
I'm pregnant. I'm giving life. What are you talking about?
I'm trying to get, you know, the point you were trying to make about this male construct of the world. So there, you know, I think there's value in thinking about it. As a woman, this issue, what would be different in the world? You know, the things that there's no such thing as enough. You know, like I heard somebody say, well, the opposite of more isn't less. The opposite of more is enough. Mm. You know, so I'm all for that. You know, if there's a womanist point of view and, you know, and I think, maybe as black women, we don't always articulate that, but I think we understand it.
I agree.
Well, I think the whole male...
Live it, for sure.
Male construct part gets a bit confusing because it's not just replacing a woman with a man.
No.
You really have to have a woman who understands the world in a different way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's not based on... more power, more authority, more resources that you get to dictate. And so sometimes when people say, you know, we want to elect a woman and we want to, that may not be what you want. Yeah, because you could have a male that is totally like reinvented himself and stripped himself of some of the patriarchy. And this is why sometimes we can vote for a white candidate because they're mm-hmm. speaking to the issues, where you could have a black person like a Clarence Thomas that completely doesn't get what being black is like. So the color thing gets to be an artificial barrier. But, you know, I think I always often see women and men get confused about just doing a woman thing. No, that woman's got to have a sense of self and sense of community in ways that men don't get it. And you can see even the way folks operate in public spaces mm-hmm. that they think that they are entitled to be there and they move in that way. So, I, you know, when I think about social feminism, I think about feminism and womanism. Mm-hmm. What does it look like for us under the current administration? We got a convicted felon of sexual predator. How are women supposed to fare in that environment? Because we see it playing out in our streets and our workplaces that men think they have a right to do certain things to women and treat them a certain way. And I'm just wondering what the women in the clubs would be thinking about now, like what progress has been made or not.
Oh, I think they'd be disappointed. They would be disappointed.
Outraged. And wouldn't stand for it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As women,
They wouldn't stand for it.
I think they'd be disappointed in us.
In women themselves, black women themselves.
We have so much. And, you know, I count myself as guilty. I haven't done enough to make sure that younger black women kind of understand this heritage. Because most of us, I think, really don't. You know, I had a student who came to me once, you know, at a woman at Wash U. She said, Dr. Hamilton, I'm just overwhelmed. I got all these issues in my life. I can't finish this assignment. So I said, wait a minute. Slavery was hard. This is not hard.
this is a cinch here, right?
No, it's not a cinch.
Yes, it is. Comparative.
You know, and she was looking at me. I said, well, no. I said, you know, whatever, I can help you get, you know, whatever you need more time, but you have to finish this. I said, don't you know you're obligated to people? They're folks whose names, women, whose names that you will never know, that I don't know, who did something that made it possible for you to have the choice of going to Washington University, and you owe them something. Mm. You know, I'm not really into this kind of self-obsession we have now, you know, this individualism. No.
It ain't about you.
You owe these folks.
Say
something.
It again.
You know, and
it
I guess
ain't
she,
about you.
It ain't I mean, about but you. I, later on, she did write me a little note and said, "Okay, I guess I never thought about slavery." But she's not there. I'm always amazed at how many black people I encounter who really don't feel any connection to whatever this thing was called slavery.
Well, that's by design too. I mean,
it is very much by design. But going back to those women, when I think about, you know, somebody like a Mary Church Terrell, who was sent, I mean, very bourgeois, married to a lawyer. She's the daughter of this real estate magnate, you know, who walked on the picket line when she was 95, you know, in Washington, D.C., still doing stuff. I think when we have, even those of us who think we don't have a lot, we have so much more than those women did. And I feel like we haven't done enough to kind of maintain the sense of our sense of culture. We've learned new things, but it hasn't been in the service of developing us as a group.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that. What do you think?
With the National Association of Colored Women, I am their national historian at this particular point. And the neatest thing that happened to me most recently was when we had a new group of young ladies being recruited. And we talk about some of our history in that organization. One of them said, I'm not doing enough. And it's like, yes, that's what
you
I
get
want
it.
People,
yeah,
I want people to feel like that.
Well, that's when I wrote the thing on Phyllis Wheatley. Some of the women who said, we aren't doing anything, are we? I said, that's right.
Yeah. Really compared to what they've done.
We aren't doing anything.
But that statement helped me to understand the value of just what we're doing right now, the three of us.
Yeah.
Talking about how we can encourage that. Annie Malone did not have one cell phone. She didn't have a mimeograph machine or a website or TikTok or any of those things. She rode in bumpy cars, and she rode on a train when it wasn't safe. And she traveled to places within the United States that wasn't safe, but she shared that information. She shared that passion for doing something that was going to improve the lives of some other people in her community, in her world. And she kept encouraging those people to do the same thing. If you see something, since the 9/11 and since the pandemic, if you see something, do something, say something. You say to children, if you see a stranger, say it's stranger danger. I mean, you've learned that you must do something. You can either hold your hand together and not one thing will get in there, or you can open up your hand and share all of what you have, all the agencies of your fingers, to do something positive, not just for yourself, but for other people.
And I know that sounds cliché-ish, and I think all of us in this room understand how we got to where we are, where that's not the norm, but let's think about what could be the norm. How do we then recreate some of the positiveness? Now, mm-hmm. some of the bourgeois attitudes about, you know, women, I agree, were a little bit condescending. But still this notion of I need to reach back and help. I don't see that, you know, in 2025. Mm-hmm. So what would we need to do as women to sort of transcend some of the pettiness that I think we're learning from these sitcoms on TV and from the wives of this and the wives of that, that we are supposed to be catfighting and talking about each other and snatching weaves off and all of that? That's
going
not who we are.
Back to the basics. When I say basics, mm-hmm. right out of the Civil War, we didn't have anybody helping us do much of anything. Mm-mm. We had a Freedmen's Bureau for a while, but that didn't last for a while. That didn't last but for a while. And the reality was we have all these people who don't have. So how are they going to get? They're going to get because I'm going to share some of what I have with you, mm-hmm. and you're going to share something with somebody else. The neatest illustration I ever saw was a round circle of a lot of people with long handle spoons. There's no way that long handle spoon could feed me. I'd have to feed the person on the other side, mm-hmm. and trust that they'll feed me, mm-hmm. or somebody else in that circle would feed me. To me, that's one of the biggest illustrations of how we can help one another. Mm-hmm. I don't have a whole lot of anything, but if I give you the little bit I have, whether it's taking care of your mom who's ill and you got to go to work, I can do that because I'm at home with my kids. Mm-hmm. Or if I get groceries for you because you can't go because you have a bunch of kids and you can't take them all with you. Whatever it might be, small or large, if I give it, it's going to help. Mm-hmm. If I share it, it's going to help. Whether it's my support, when you were going to school, you said your community, your mm-hmm. black community, mm-hmm. you were a product of that because they helped you, they encouraged you. That's important. Encouragement is very important. Mm-hmm. I might not have much, but if I give what I have, because I wouldn't have got it if God didn't give it to me in the first place. Yeah. That's just what I believe. Mm-hmm. A lot of people believe in different ways, but I do believe to do some of that, to do is the mm-hmm. operative there, yeah. is to do.
And right? I like that in service of
others.
Of others. That's yeah. a powerful thing. Mm-hmm.
But on a practical level, you know, I keep thinking about we need to do something like the Freedom Schools. You know, we've had two iterations. One was the Freedom Schools right after slavery, right, where black people lining up to learn how to read, right, mm-hmm. informal. We need to find set up structures where people get together on a regular basis and talk about some and learn stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I talk to white people all the time about black history. I rarely talk to black people. I've never hardly ever asked to talk about black history. But I'd love that, you know, informally. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I'm not that interested in academia, if I ever was. But I do believe that knowing is important, and it's important for everybody to know that, not just a few. So, I always think we need a mechanism that kind of recreates maybe what we had
back to basics
in segregated schools.
Yeah, I have to tell people that wasn't all bad. It was the not equal part that
it was
bad.
The not equal part.
The segregated part, we really benefited from part.
It was the not equal part, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
In some ways. I never had, all of my education was segregated. I never had integrated education until I went to graduate school. Okay, so but I never had anybody say to me, I should go into criminal justice. As a major, whatever that is, right? Or, you know, I never had anybody say to me, well, you know, you're a black girl, why do you care about the Protestant Reformation of the 1600s. No teacher ever said I shouldn't be interested.
Are you not college material?
Don't
waste your parents' money.
Right.
So, I mean, I think, but actually, because the culture has changed. So although, you know, everybody, the adults worked, and we never ate dinner together, except for on holidays. I'm just thinking, but there seemed to be these occasions when we were together and they would be talking about Governor Faubus in Arkansas, right? And George Wallace. We would, it was more than just the news, you know. Mm-hmm, like I had a grandfather who only went to sixth grade. He read the whole paper every day and wanted to understand stuff. And his friends were like that, right? So we need to find a way, and the internet isn't helping, right? The way we connect to people isn't helping. Where we could have kind of informal groupings where we kind of people start
talking to each other.
About, yes.
Talking to each other instead of to the phone.
I used to be embarrassed that my son would say, oh, don't turn her on. She don't turn off very well. But I've come to like that.
Yeah.
I've come to appreciate what that really means. I would say I will talk to anybody about Annie Malone who's willing to listen. Because her story is not just compelling. It's inspiring.
Yeah.
It's important to know that this person who was orphaned, who didn't have much of anything, rose to be a millionaire who wasn't afraid to give it away.
Right.
Okay? I think those things are important. I used to think I had nothing to say to anybody. But I have things to share with people. Things that I learned, I share with another person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my value comes. I learned about Mary Ellen Pleasant, who was another African-American millionaire. And she wasn't the first one.
Mammy Pleasant.
Mammy. There you go. Yes, they did call her Mammy Pleasant, yes.
I used to have her recipe book.
Oh, God. Here we go.
It's like, wow, that is something else. But that's my point.
Yeah, you and I know, but I
and
want
we need to
all,
share
I
it.
Want everybody, all black people to know about
I want as many
Pleasant.
As who will listen to me.
But that's why, Linda, I said that. That exhibit that you had, that needs to be a standing exhibit, or at least one traveling around
all
of the time.
It travels.
But, and, you know, because I just think that the inspiring notion about somebody who literally had nothing and through her own ingenuity and business acumen was able to help literally, I would say, millions. Because her stuff was worldwide, but then in the communities that she was in, all of those folks benefited as well. And so I can't think of anybody who...
She gave college scholarships
to
multiple colleges for multiple years.
Yeah.
She did it in community.
That's right.
And I really think, again, the way society is structured now, right? And there's this veneer that what's the term people were using after Obama?
Post-race.
Right. We're in this. Yes. So it's very difficult for people to connect to community in the way they used to, or to feel that sense.
And then, a lot of our physical communities have been disruptive, and so we're scattered, and so it really is difficult. But, you know, we could do this for another hour, but we have to close this out, you all. I thank you so much for the history, because this is history. History that is still happening. I just wish that, you know, people could go to the corner where Annie Malone had the whole damn corner she had bought. I mean, the whole shebang. And we walk right past there and don't even know it. There's not even a marker there to say, hey, this woman did this. And so that's on us, y'all. That is really, really on us to keep our history alive. And certainly Tulia Hamilton and Linda Nance have helped us do that today. Tomorrow, but folks who know John and Susie Chastoff, there will be a farewell party. They are moving and relocating to Costa Rica. So if you want to join and say goodbye to them, that's tomorrow, 6 o'clock at the Deaconess Center, 1000 North Vandeventer. And we'll have a little refreshments, but you get a chance to say goodbye to them. Some of us want to leave this godforsaken place, but we're going to be stuck here. We're going to fight to the end, and I'm one of them. But, you know, they're going, and we're going to wish them well. Last week I mentioned that the boycott started with Target on the 6th. That's still going on. There's going to be a rally at the Target in Brentwood. I think it's at 10. I'm not sure. I'm going to try to get that up on my website. But it's working, y'all. They're losing money. Now, these are the folks, and so you understand the connection, they were in Minneapolis when George Floyd, and they pledged billions of dollars, and then they reneged soon as your boy in the White House said, we ain't doing that no more. And so that's why they're the first target. So we got to do that. And then last but not least, Tennessee State University is having their annual scholarship dance, as they normally do on the third week in March. And that's going to be, as it has been, at the, what's the hall out on St. Charles Rock Road? Oh, dang, y'all. Okay, I'm going to put that up on my website, too. But, yeah, that's a historically black college, and we want to get some scholarships there going. So, yeah, let's make sure we support all the right things that we're supposed to do, y'all. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and I will see you then.
Thank you. It was wonderful meeting you.